Hey, welcome back to Good Growing with the Garden Gal. I'm George Corliss.
And I'm Jelaine Fenner.
And this program, folks, is a brand new program here on Strong Tower Radio. And it's to help you to become stewards of your own natural resources. And it doesn't matter if you're a farmer, a backyard gardener, even a box gardener. We can even talk about that, right? I mean, a lot of people live in the senior communities and some other things like that and don't really have an area that they can rototill up, but you can do a lot of things with boxes or even 5-gallon buckets. And I've seen people, I mean, they're quite inventive anymore. Maybe you've got a lot of trees on your land, so forestry is important to you, or animal husbandry. The goal of the program is to provide information and education on these subjects and more. And we've got the Garden Gal herself with us. She's Teresa Williams from the Wexford Conservation District. And Jelaine, you had a follow-up question with the wood chips. Why don't you?
Well, I was just, you know, I guess partly because my husband being also, he's a farmer, but he was a contractor. You use treated wood when you're building things. And I know if you're going to do some of the, you were calling it box gardening. What do you call that? The
raised beds?
Raised beds, yes. Because I had a little raised bed and a little, I have a house on Lake Mitchell. I had a little raised bed. I'm sorry, but you might want the treated wood to hold everything in. Is that or not?
Well, I'll tell my experience. When people treat wood, what they're treating it with generally is a fungicide, something that's going to stop fungi from rotting the wood. In a garden situation, you might want those fungi to rot the wood because what they're doing is they're cycling the nutrients. If you have the option of selecting a wood that is naturally rot resistant, I think that's the best choice. In our area, white cedar grows, and white cedar has some natural rot resistance, so it makes the ideal wood for creating a garden bed.
Okay, as you go through this with maybe some of the other choices too, where do you pick white cedar up around here?
A home sawmill? In Osceola County is one place.
Okay.
Allen Holmes down there.
Are we ever educating people?
Okay. So what about other, what are some other rot resistant or whatever types of woods?
Black locust is a rot resistant wood. The red cedar is somewhat rot resistant. So is redwood rot resistant, and cypress. In our area, white cedar is going to be the thing you most likely will find. I know some of the bigger lumber stores do carry some of the western red cedar. So that might be easier to find. It all depends where you go.
Okay, so a red cedar, not painted red.
Not painted. The tree red cedar, or red wood. The tree redwood. Okay. Both of those have some natural rot resistance.
Okay. And today we're talking about soils, folks. And Teresa, what about soil testing and adjusting the mineral nutrients of your soil?
It's something I think is a good idea because when you look at a soil, you can discern things about its texture. You can tell just by looking, is it sand or is it clay? You can tell a great deal by looking how much organic matter is in the soil, those dark particles that you mentioned earlier. But you can't tell by looking what the pH is or what the mineral nutrient content is of that soil.
Explain what pH means.
pH is a measure of the acidity of the soil. Technically, pH stands for potential hydrogen, which I don't know how technical you want me to get here, but the level of hydrogen has to do with how acidic that soil is. So when we're growing a garden, most of the time we want to shoot for a pH of about 6.5. That's a good number to know. How close are you to 6.5? And you can find that out a couple of ways. You can buy test strips at any garden center, pretty much has those. Not the best method because all that test strip will tell you is the pH. There's another piece of information that's really important, and that's something called the lime index or the cation exchange capacity.
The what?
It's called two different things. There's two terms for the same concept. One is either lime index or cation exchange capacity. And what that tells you is how much lime for your particular soil texture you're going to need to get it to the pH that you want.
So what I'm just hearing you say, my husband being a farmer, they put lime on the soil. It depends what the soil is, if you need more or less
correct.
Lime.
Okay. That's right. A sandy soil, you can change the pH. Say you have an acidic soil and it's down near 5, and that's really too acidic for most crops except blueberries. If you need to raise your pH, you would add lime. If you have a sandy soil, you would get a certain recommendation for how much lime to add. If you had a clay soil at the exact same pH, you're going to need 2 to 3 times as much lime to get it to the same pH level.
Now, what happens when soils are different in a garden? I mean, usually, if I remember correctly, I took 3 or 4 or 5 samples from all over the garden, not just in one part of the garden, right?
That's a great idea, and that's what we recommend to take. For every place that you're going to manage the same way, we call it like a management unit. You would take a multitude of samples and take the samples to the depth of your root zone. So in a garden, take a trowel full of soil down to about 8 inches in several places from the garden. Mix that all together to come up with the soil that you would send away to a lab to get sampled, to get tested.
Okay, and how much does it cost normally?
It varies depending on what service you use. I'll give a couple of examples. Sure. Here in Michigan, the Michigan State University Extension Service has a soil sample test kit for gardeners, and it's great. You can order it online or go to any extension office. It costs you $25, and it comes with a prepaid envelope mailer. You put your 1 cup of soil in the envelope. You fill out an information sheet telling a little bit about what you're going to grow and what you have grown, mail it off, and then they email you the results back. And that test costs $25. We also have some of our agricultural co-ops who send it off to different labs. And depending on which lab they use and which agriculture co-op you go to, they're usually a little cheaper, more in the $15 range.
Now, Jelaine, does Brian do that, your husband, with some of his fields?
Well, this year, my son has really gotten even more involved with the farm, and he hired somebody to come in and test. I mean, we own about 400 acres, but they farm maybe almost 1,500 acres. So even though it's not our land, but we're farming it, he needs to have it tested. And so he had somebody come in and was, you know, different samples all over. I don't know how many they did to test the soil. Because over the years, usually they put nitrogen, they put lime, you know, depending on the test. Yeah, that's why I was asking you about the lime. How do you decide? Well, you've got to test the soil. Yeah.
And that's why I think it's good to send it off to the lab to find that other part of the equation. Because a pH test strip will only tell you the pH. It won't tell you how much lime you'll need if your soil is too acidic.
And so we're talking about lime, we're talking about nitrogen. What about just building the soil up with these, you know, organic nutrients that you keep talking about? I mean, are these like, does a person have to start, what do they call those piles where they...
Compost.
Compost piles. Is that the best right there or what?
Well, it's a big topic and I need to break it down just a little bit.
Right. We got
because compost piles can be full of all kinds of stuff.
It can be. If we're looking at the mineral nutrients in a soil, we're talking, first of all, we need to pay attention to the pH, which we've covered fairly well. Then there's what we call macronutrients and the minor nutrients and micronutrients. Our macronutrients in a mineral setting are our phosphorus and our potassium.
My eyes just got really big, you guys.
Oops.
That's all right.
But the farmers, yeah, they this put phosphorus. They know, right? Yeah, farmers do this.
And a soil test will tell you phosphorus levels and it will tell you potassium levels. Any lab you send it off to is going to tell you those two things because those are mineral elements and you can measure them. Those same soil tests won't tell you nitrogen. And the reason they won't tell you nitrogen isn't because it's a bad lab. That's not it at all. It's because nitrogen availability is highly dependent on biological activity. We've got all kinds of nitrogen. 78% of our atmosphere is nitrogen. The key is getting that atmospheric nitrogen turned into a form that our plants can use. So, and that depends on nutrient cycling in the soil, and it's a biological process. So your soil tests aren't going to tell you nitrogen unless you get, there's a very specific test called nitrogen side dress test, and you can only do it once the soils have warmed up in our area in June, and then you can find out nitrogen levels if you want. And those are our three macronutrients, the things that we most often have to supply: nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium.
And where would you pick those up if your soil is lacking?
You have a couple you have several choices. Any fertilizer that you would look at a store is going to have a label, and it's going to have three numbers separated by a dash. For instance, 10-12-8.
A lot of times for especially grass, you see those big things that you put on bags of.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And those three numbers represent the nutrients that are in that bag of fertilizer. And the first number represents what percentage is nitrogen. The second is what percentage is phosphorus, and the third is what percentage is potassium, or potash, sometimes people call it.
And what do you find as an example, generalities anyway, with people and even with your own garden, what do you find is lacking around here?
Nitrogen.
Nitrogen, why?
Because of low organic matter in so many of our soils. It's dependent on a biological process, naturally occurring nitrogen. And if you crop a soil year after year and you don't add organic matter back into it, you're going to be deficient in nitrogen fairly soon.
That's why farmers do a cover crop.
That's one of the ways they can get nitrogen back. They can get it also back through manure. Mm-hmm. And you can buy bags of nitrogen fertilizer in an inorganic form. You can get that.
And I was going to say manure, a lot of people, because you know we also have a cow operation, people will call one, oh, can we come and get, you know,
for their garden?
Yeah, a truckload of manure. And because the manure really does help the crops grow.
Manure does a few things. It provides that organic matter and some nutrients.
But it'll add weeds too.
That is true.
So compost piles though, what do you put in them? You put grass and you put lawn clippings, like those types of things, and what?
In a compost pile, you can put in any organic matter. The key is to get your carbon and nitrogen ratio about right. And if we think of brown things of adding carbon, such as dried leaves, straw, those are brown things. And we think of green things as adding nitrogen, like grass clippings, and even like vegetable scraps. They might not be green, but we count that as a nitrogen source. So we put it in the green category.
Some people have, food, vegetables. You know.
So you can layer, it's important to layer those browns and those greens and keep it as damp as a wringed out sponge, because we need air and we need water both. So if your pile is slightly moist, but you can't squeeze water out of it, that's good. And if you turn it, you continue to provide oxygen to that pile and oxygen to the microbes that are going to decompose it. And it doesn't hurt at all to put a few handfuls of soil in when you're building that compost pile, because that can be a source of those microbes.
And that's then a whole lot cheaper than going to the store and buying, you know,
black dirt.
Yeah, black dirt. Yeah.
If you have a source of the greens and the browns. Yeah. You can also buy, there's some wonderful compost makers anymore, and you can buy a wonderful compost product. So if you don't have a source of greens and browns yourself, you can get the benefits of compost.
I look at, and I mean, if you live in any small city, but even up to large cities, every year in the fall and then in the spring, they collect leaves and they put them in the bags. I mean, you could get as many bags as you want and just throw the bags on the compost pile, couldn't you?
You could, but there's one thing I want to warn folks about. If someone has used a weed and feed product on their lawn, the weed and feed products have an herbicide in them. And if you use lawn clippings from a lawn that has been treated with a weed and feed product, you could be adding a plant killer to your compost pile, which is really not what you want to do. You don't want to kill your plants after you've gone to the trouble of making compost for them.
Didn't think of that.
You have to know a little bit about those clippings.
Okay, so if you don't have any grass clippings, but just in the fall, like
leaves,
maple trees, I mean, and there's bags and bags. If that's all you were using, the bags that, you know, you're raking up the leaves.
But you're saying you need green on top of the bags.
Green. Yeah, you need, because those bags of leaves could be lots and lots of carbon without any nitrogen to help.
Oh, okay.
You need that nitrogen in there to help the decomposition
process. So what would you suggest? Let's say that I went and got 50 bags of those and put them in, you know, like in a wherever. I need to put green on top of those. Where am I going to get green enough to deal with that?
Well, manure can, fresh manure can be high in
so
nitrogen.
So put manure right
manure
on top of that.
Manure with leaves could work. I think randomly collecting bags, you just don't know what you're going to get. I'm not sure that's the best option for you.
Unless maybe they were your own.
I'm unless they were your
thinking
own.
Thinking about me raking up those maple tree leaves. Oh, yeah. My goodness.
If you, it's better if you know what it is that you're putting in your compost pile, because then you have some knowledge of, well, do I have a green in balance with my brown, and make sure that you don't have anything in there that you wouldn't want to apply to the place where you're growing your food.
Right, and I know there's a product called Dairy Do. A lot of people will
that's
go
a
buy
compost.
That,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And they pay big money for
yes,
it, too.
Yes, they do.
And I noticed that a lot of farmers are having that put on their, you know, croplands and some of the other
well,
things.
Well, that's why, I mean, like, because we've got the cow operation. We take the manure and spread it all over the fields.
And then, Teresa, I noticed when I, especially, I lived in Southern Illinois for a couple of years, the farmers planted corn 1 year and then soybeans the next.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so crop rotation obviously is important. Is that important to a like a regular backyard gardener too?
I think it is as much as you can. A backyard gardener, if you're dealing with a very small garden, you don't have a whole lot of options. Because what you're trying to do with crop rotation is create an area where you don't have the same plant families growing for at least 4 years. And the reason for that is you can break a disease cycle that way if you wait 4 years between plant families. If you have a small garden, you might not have the luxury of that. But if you have a garden large enough where you can say, all right, I planted my peas and beans here this year, I'm going to wait 4 years before I put peas and beans in that area again, it's a great option.
Now, David, who is our general manager here at the station, they have an influx of potato bugs. Mm-hmm. It just took over their whole garden. They didn't even plant a garden last year because of that reason. Mm-hmm. Now, what can they do about something like that? Because that's what's happened. They probably planted the same things in the same area year after year after year, and the bugs just got used to it. Kind of, am I correct or not?
Well, potato beetles are one of the most pernicious insects we deal with in the United States. They adapt very easily to different controlling sprays, so we have to do a lot to control potato beetles. And the first thing we have to do is create the most healthy environment that we can for potatoes. Potatoes like a very steady level of moisture. They don't like fluctuating moisture levels at all. And when a plant gets stressed, a plant suddenly becomes much more attractive to any insect pest. So with potatoes, one thing to do is after your second hilling, mulch it very heavily with straw, and that's going to help you keep an even moisture level in the garden. The next thing to do is you want to scout for potato beetles and try and get them at the very earliest stages. You can see the brown larvae that look kind of like a snail without its shell. It's this very rounded brown insect that'll be on the leaves. Even before that, there's eggs that, when they're freshly laid, will be yellow, and the older they get, the closer to hatching they get, they'll turn brown. You can destroy the egg masses. You can pick off larvae. There are different sprays that you can use. One of them that is one of the least toxic methods is a spray called spinosad, and it's a bacteria. It's certified for use in organic agriculture, if that's something you're interested in. And if you go through, and when you start seeing those larvae on the plants, if you spray it once with spinosad and come back a week or two later and then pick off the potato beetles, any that you see, you can prevent the population of potato beetles on your farm from developing resistance to that. And that's very important because they so easily can develop resistance to any pesticide, organic or not. If you spray with any pesticide and then go back and get the ones that either you missed or that were resistant,
but
made it through for some reason, either pick them off or choose a different type of spray. And that helps tremendously with taking care of the potato beetle problem.
You'll have to talk more with David because they were just really discouraged. They felt like they did everything they possibly could and tried everything. So that's a great thing. And folks, if you have questions, Teresa's going to be here. We plan on being here around once a month and discussing different topics that I think all of you will be interested in. And I want to thank you for tuning in today to Good Growing with the Garden Gal. I'm George Corliss.
I'm Jelaine Finner.
And I'm Teresa Williams.
And make sure you tune in next time for Good Growing with the Garden Gal.